He didn't recognize that the girl in the bed next to him was his sister. His entire family, parents and the rest of his siblings, were killed in the same attack. That boy survived. And the next day, I went to see him, a very young plastic surgeon, one of the few remaining plastic surgeons in Gaza, because the others have either been killed or have fled, understandably, had removed part of his chest and created a graft to cover those vital organs of the neck. He was lying in his bed and mumbling because it was so difficult to talk, and he kept saying, I got really close to him, and he said, I wish I had died too. And I said, what? And he said, I think my entire family has gone to heaven. It's not my entire family. His exact words were something effective. Everybody I love is now in heaven. I don't want to be here anymore. That is one of so many stories. I'm so sorry, Leila, but I think people need to hear this. I'm giving you the story of one child. One of my healthcare worker colleagues, a young nurse, one of the most dedicated nurses I've ever met, was trying to evacuate a patient when Al Shifa Hospital was bombed from north to south. He carried that patient, was eventually called by Israeli forces, not by name, but by uniform. You, the person in scrubs, come here. He was subsequently detained for 53 days. He reported physical, sexual, and psychological torture while in detention and ultimately released because he had no crime. After he was released, he worked constantly because, one, he was so dedicated, and two, he suffered from severe insomnia from the trauma of his detention. He was always in the resuscitation room of the emergency department, cleaning out sand from the eyes of people pulled from under the rubble, trying to comfort them. One day, overnight, he fell asleep holding the body of a dead child still with the breathing tube in after they had failed to resuscitate the infant. Another day, I asked him to go home because he hadn't slept in so many hours, so he left the hospital. A couple hours later, I see him in the emergency department trying to resuscitate a man whose both legs and one arm had been blown off. I asked him what he was doing in the hospital. I thought you went home to rest. And he said, this is my sister's husband. They woke me up to tell me that the aid distribution site had been bombed and my sister's husband had gone there. So I went to find him and found him severely injured. So I helped him resuscitate this patient. His home has been destroyed. He's a young man, he's engaged, he's trying to get married, he had a whole life ahead of him, and he was a very dedicated healthcare worker. I'm giving you two stories, a child and a healthcare worker, but these are representative of literally almost everybody I know in Gaza. I don't know a single healthcare worker who has not lost multiple members of their family. So, as the U.S. continues to fund this military campaign unconditionally and somewhat blindly, in stark contrast to documented realities on the ground, in stark contrast to the findings of the International Court of Justice of plausible genocide, and in stark contrast to the universal global condemnation of humanitarian and human rights organizations, we have no choice but to exert as much pressure as possible and use all the leverage we can to change direction, the direction that this country is taking.
That was Dr. Tanya Hashhassan, a pediatric intensive care surgeon who's volunteered in Gaza hospitals a number of times. Leila El Abed, the co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement, who is seated right next to her, was overcome with emotion and briefly walked out during Hashhassan's comments. Leila El Abed later responded to a question about the plans for the Uncommitted Movement between now and November.
We stand at a very crucial moment for our party. The Democratic Party, the party of my father, the party that has stood up for justice, is being tested. Will it rise for the occasion and stand for the values that it was built on? Freedom, equality, justice? Or will it remain silent in the face of unimaginable suffering? If we remain silent and we become complicit, but if we stand up and demand action, an arms embargo, a ceasefire, an end to war, we may have an opportunity to restore the soul of the Democratic Party and unite us under a big tent. The Listen to Michigan and the Uncommitted National Movement is in the fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. I want to quote Fannie Lou Hamer, who wasn't allowed to speak from the stage at the 1964 Democratic National Convention because of her identity. I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave? All we are doing right now is in the tradition of Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi Freedom Party and the civil rights movement of the 1964 Democratic Party Convention, bringing moral witness to the most powerful political party in the world, to listen to voices deeply impacted by our U.S. policy decisions. We aren't that different from any other movement, from unions, civil rights, gay marriage, reproductive rights, or climate justice. We are fighting to be recognized, to be part of this party, and we are fighting for this party to believe in our equal rights. Hella and I shouldn't have to stand up here and tell you the suffering of our family members. For Democrats and for this administration and for Vice President Harris to want to do the moral and right thing to do.
Leila El-Abed is co-chair of the Uncommitted Movement, speaking at the first ever panel on Palestinian human rights here at the DNC. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
On Monday night, President Biden headlined the opening night of the Democratic National Convention. Biden's speech came less than a month after he announced he ended his reelection campaign, paving the way for Vice President Kamala Harris's nomination. On Monday night, Biden briefly spoke about Israel's war on Gaza.
We're working around the clock, my Secretary of State, to prevent a wider war and reunite hostages with their families and surge humanitarian health and food assistance into Gaza now. To end the civilian suffering of the Palestinian people and finally deliver a ceasefire and end this war. Those protesters out in the street, they have a point. A lot of innocent people are being killed on both sides.
A few minutes into President Biden's remarks, three delegates, part of Delegates Against Genocide, dropped a banner that read, "Stop Arming Israel." We were inside the convention floor right next to the Florida delegation where it happened. While some delegates snatched the banner away, many others of the Florida delegation quickly raised Joe Biden placards that said, "Thank you, Joe, and we love Joe," to block any view of the banner. The protesting delegates who dropped the banner were quickly escorted from the convention floor by security. We're going to go to that moment inside the convention on opening night.
Okay. Mariano Sharon. I'm a DNC delegate from Michigan.
And what did you do today?
Today we held up a sign protesting the murder of children in Gaza and the continuing genocide.
Watch your step. What did the sign say?
It said, stop arming Israel.
All right, thank you. Let's keep it going. Let's get into the tunnel. You can interview him in the tunnel, okay?
And what happened
I just don't want you to break your ankles.
Then the people behind us grabbed a hold of the sign and tried to rip it out of our hands several times. Eventually, they succeeded.
Interview in the hall, okay? Let's get him down. Come on. All right, thanks for being cooperative, sir.
Yeah,
okay.
No problem.
Thank you.
And why did you do it?
I did that because we are currently funding a genocide, and it needs to stop. And also, I want to make it clear to the Harris campaign that this is actually in their interest. Okay. Netanyahu is trying to instigate a larger war so he could remain in power and avoid going to prison. In order to move Netanyahu off of his current position of trying to expand the war in order to stay in power and remain out of jail, we believe that the U.S. needs to stop arming Israel. It needs to have an embargo against their genocide. Otherwise, Netanyahu doesn't have the incentive to stop the genocide, to stop the mass murder.
Why does this matter to you so much?
It matters to me so much because I'm a Jew, and I was always brought up to believe that never again means never again for anyone, anywhere, ever, period. And that's not what's happening right now. What's happening right now is that we are continuing to fund and support an ongoing genocide, the mass murder of children, and it needs to stop.
Voices from inside the Democratic National Convention Monday night during President Biden's remarks. Special thanks to Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, and Nermeen Sheikh. It was when three of the delegates, part of a group called Delegates Against Genocide, dropped a banner that read, "Stop Arming Israel." We'll speak with all three delegates in our other hour of War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Conventions. Stay tuned. When we come back, we look at the life and legacy of pioneering TV host Phil Donahue. Stay with us.
الجنوب لكي يقاوم إن تاريخ الإباء غير نايم يكتب عن أرضنا أرض الملاحم هذا مجدك بالمذلة والهزائم الجنوب لكي يقاوم إن تاريخ الإباء غير نايم يكتب عن أرضنا أرض الملاحم إني أهل العزم إن تدعى بالوغى بالموت قائم إن شعبي كله وطن مقاوم مرتضى غير المعزة والمكارم إني أهل العزم إن تدعى العزائم هذا سيفي بالوغى بالموت قائم إن شعبي كله وطن مقاوم
مقوام Resistance by Julia Boutros. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman here in Chicago with Juan Gonzalez.
We end this hour looking at the life and legacy of the pioneering TV host Phil Donahue, who died Sunday at the age of 88. Beginning in the 1960s, Donahue hosted a groundbreaking daily talk show that helped transform daytime TV. He tackled major social and political issues, including women's rights, child abuse in the Catholic Church, prisons, racism, and the Middle East. Over his career, Donahue won 20 Emmy Awards and a Peabody Award. He ended his daytime show in 1996, but returned to the airwaves in 2002 to host a primetime talk show on MSNBC in the run-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It became the most popular talk show on MSNBC, but Donahue was fired in 2003 for airing anti-war voices.
An internal MSNBC memo warned Donahue was a, quote, difficult public face for NBC in a time of war because, quote, he seems to delight in presenting guests who are anti-war, anti-Bush, and skeptical of the administration's motives, unquote. The memo also warned Donahue was providing a, quote, home for the liberal anti-war agenda at the same time that our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity, unquote. In 2013, Juan Gonzalez and I spoke to Phil Donahue in our New York studio about his firing.
Well, I think what happened to me, the biggest lesson, I think, is the how corporate media shapes our opinions and our coverage. This was my decision, the decision to release me, came from far above. This was not an assistant program director who decided to separate me from MSNBC. They were terrified of the anti-war voice, and that is not an overstatement. Anti-war voices were not popular. And if you're General Electric, you certainly don't want an anti-war voice on a cable channel that you own. Donald Rumsfeld's your biggest customer. So, by the way, I had to have two conservatives on for every liberal. I could have Richard Perle on alone, but I couldn't have Dennis Kucinich on alone. I was considered two liberals. It really is funny almost when you look back on how the management was just frozen by the anti-war voice. We were scolds. We weren't patriotic. American people disagreed with us, and we weren't good for business.
Phil, the irony that MSNBC now is supposedly this liberal network now, that you wonder, though, if another move to war came, how liberal it would remain.
Well, you know, the coin of the realm is the size of the audience. It's important to see this. When a broadcasting executive gets out of bed in the morning before his foot hits the floor, his thoughts are ratings. What are my ratings? Not unlike Wall Street people who get and CEOs, their first thought is the price of their stock.
So that was Phil Donahue speaking on Democracy Now! In 2013. About a decade after being fired from MSNBC in the lead-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. We're joined now by Jeff Cohen, who worked as a senior producer on Phil Donahue's MSNBC primetime show. And Jeff wrote about the experience in his book, Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. Jeff Cohen is also the co-founder of the online action group RootsAction.org and founder of the media watch group FAIR. That's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He's a former professor of journalism and the director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. Jeff, it's so interesting to be here in Chicago and so sad to hear about the news of Phil dying this weekend in New York, because while Phil started the Phil Donahue Show in Dayton, Ohio, as it was syndicated, he was here in Chicago, his show, for years. Can you talk about the life and legacy of Phil Donahue?
Well, it was so exciting to hear Phil's voice again from your interview from 2013. He changed television. He changed our country. His three most frequent guests on his daytime show, where he took issues of civil rights, gay rights, women's rights, corporate greed, he mainstreamed those issues. And his three most frequent guests on the daytime show was the feminist advocate Gloria Steinem. It was Ralph Nader, the great foe of corporate greed, and Reverend Jesse Jackson. Aside from those three, he also kept featuring Dr. Sidney Wolfe, an ally of Ralph Nader, who talked about the greed of the pharmaceutical industry and unsafe drugs. So it's an incredible legacy. He had an audience of millions. Phil was a progressive. He was for peace and justice. He exuded it. It's what made him tick. And, you know, I've read some of the obituaries in mainstream media talking about how Phil had shows about male strippers, or he wore a dress on one show. The essence of Phil Donahue can be seen by who his guests were and what issues motivated him. The beauty of the daytime show was that he had somewhat autonomy. He didn't have suits. When we were at MSNBC together and we were getting these crazy orders that you've referenced already, Phil referred to the executives as Suit Phil or the suits. He didn't have that in the daytime show. And he built this amazing thing. He opened the door for Oprah Winfrey. But mostly, he got the United States public, largely a female audience, talking about issues that no one else in television was talking about. So it was really something for him when he came out of a very happy retirement in the 90s. And he goes to MSNBC. And all of a sudden, the suits are saying, Phil Donahue, we hired you. You're one of the most famous people in the history of television. We're going to tell you what to do. And he bristled at it. He resisted it. They stifled him. And then ultimately, they terminated all of us.
And Jeff, he was also one of the few people who ever had Noam Chomsky, probably the most world-renowned U.S. intellectual of the late 20th century, on his show. Could you talk about that, and also what happened when you were a producer when he was at MSNBC, the experience that you saw firsthand with him and the suits, as you mentioned?
Yeah, I first met Phil Donahue when he had the big daytime show in the 90s, and he wanted to do a show, What's Wrong with Corporate News Media? And, you know, he wanted to feature Fair's Critique. So he had me on with Michael Moore, Jim Hightower, and Donna Edwards on the daytime show, Here's What's Wrong with Corporate-Controlled U.S. News Media. So he comes out of his happy retirement to go to MSNBC, and the suits, they got us there by promising we would be able to counter-program against Bill O'Reilly. We could have Noam Chomsky. We could have all of these independent experts that Democracy Now! Audiences know about, but they were not getting on cable news. And they gave us assurances. That's the reason that we went to MSNBC. And there was a gap. We were hired in around March of 2002. We didn't go on the air till July of 2002. By then, we know from the internal discussions, memos have leaked, emails have leaked. They were worried about, hell, we've hired Phil Donahue. And they started telling us we had to be balanced. And then as the war neared, we got closer and closer to the Iraq invasion. They gave us that quota system that Phil talked about. If we had one guest on who was against the impending invasion, we had to have two that were pro-war. If we had two guests on the left, we had to have three on the right. And when a producer said, I think I could book Michael Moore, she was told, who was obviously known as a critic of the impending invasion, she was told, for political balance, you'll have to have three right-wingers to balance Michael Moore. And, you know, I thought privately about proposing Noam Chomsky as a guest, but our stage could not accommodate the 38 right-wingers we would have needed for balance. What has to be understood is, when we were terminated, we were the most watched program on MSNBC. Now, that's not saying a lot, because MSNBC was in third place, but it's very rare that Suitville, the suits at any network, will terminate their most watched program. But that's what they did, because they were scared witless that we were putting on experts, trying to. Often they would be outshouted because of that quota system. We had Phyllis Bennis, we had Dennis Kucinich, we had Bernie Sanders talking about the war. We had Ramsey Clark, a former U.S. Attorney General. And the next morning, what did the suits tell us? Ramsey Clark is never supposed to appear on MSNBC. There was some sort of blacklist that we didn't know about. And remember, this was 2003. It wasn't 1953 during the Joe McCarthy witch hunts. But we were constantly told by the suits, Bill is coming across as un-American, as unpatriotic, because he was doing journalism, which was a crime in that era. But we were given all this bunk from the suits, and it made you feel like you were back in 1953 and not 2003.
Jeff, interestingly, in 2006, a few years after the U.S. invaded Iraq, I had an unusual experience related to Phil Donahue. It was the 10th anniversary of MSNBC, and I was invited on Hardball by Chris Matthews, along with Michael Smirkanish, who would later become a host on CNN. We were standing outside 30 Rock. All the executives were on the top floor of 30 Rock, and they were about to have a big party. The audience was all standing there. They were told to wave the American flag if they wanted to ask a question. We were just coming out of a commercial.
I want to congratulate you, Chris, on 10 years of MSNBC, but I wish standing with you was Phil Donahue. He shouldn't have been fired for expressing an anti-war point of view on the eve of the election. His point of view and the people he brought on were also
I don't know what the reasons were, but I doubt it was that.
Well, we have the NBC memo. That was a secret memo that came out that said they didn't want him to be the face of this network, an anti-war face at a time when the other networks were waving.
Can I answer the question?
So that was talking about Phil Donahue on MSNBC after he was fired on the Chris Matthews show, who also ultimately left MSNBC. Jeff Cohen, Phil would later go on to produce Body of War, the story of an Iraq War veteran who was paralyzed, shot in Iraq, Thomas Young, in a remarkable film. But before we end, I wanted to ask you, you know, we're here in Chicago for the Democratic Convention, and you are co-founder of the online action group Roots Action. You served as senior producer, yes, on Phil's show, but you also were one of the people now who pushed for Biden to step aside. We just have 30 seconds. If you can comment on that first night of the convention and the kind of swan song that President Biden gave there.
It was so important that it was a swan song. The Democratic Party has been heading toward defeat and delivering the country for a neo-fascist victory of Trump and his movement in November. 20 months ago, we started Don't Run Joe. It became Step Aside Joe. We are so thrilled that he stepped aside. We took out ads in The Hill. We put ads on MSNBC and CNN on Washington, D.C. television and in a bunch of swing states. It took a long time. We wanted Joe to step aside so there'd be an open primary process. But believe me, it's a good thing he stepped aside. Now there's a chance that MAGA can be defeated in November. And there was no chance 5 weeks ago.
Jeff Cohen, we want to thank you for being with us, co-founder of the online action group RootsAction.org, served as senior producer on Phil Donahue, MSNBC primetime show, and wrote about the experience in Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in the Corporate Media. Phil died this weekend at the age of 88. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now! Breaking with Convention.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday. From 3 to 4 p.m. Your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.